This week on Prepping 2.0.
Fermenting with confidence and some of the new tools and resources out there that can make it so you're like, no, I know that I can do this right.
When disaster strikes, will you be prepared? This is Prepping 2.0 with authors and prepping experts, Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Online at prepping2-0.com.
Get ready. Prepping 2.0 coming in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome, everyone. This is Shelby Gallagher over here at Prepping 2.0. And I'm not joined by my co-host on the show and co-host in life, Glenn Tate, but that's okay. He's out and about doing things and slaying dragons and, you know, conquering the world. So it's all good. So one topic I have a love for is fermenting. And we've had a complicated relationship. And sometimes we've been on timeouts, and right now we are back together again. And what I've discovered in all of this are there's a whole slew of new technologies and tools out there that can really give all of us confidence in fermenting. But as always, remember, the only thing harder than planning for a disaster is explaining why you didn't. I hope you've all taken a moment to jump over to our website at prepping2-0.com and click on Friends and Affiliates. There's some great folks over there that help us keep the lights on, and one of them is Survival Garden Seeds. I have really enjoyed really digging into them this spring and using a lot of them, especially this time of year when it's still kind of chilly outside. I've definitely dug into some of their broccolis and cabbages, which are kind of chilly weather sorts of crops, and getting into those. And the germination and the success rate on those are through the roof. And I encourage you to check them out for your gardening needs over at prepping2-0.com. As always, we always like to check in and see what are good things to think about in case of a collapse. What better place to look than Bosnia when it collapsed several decades ago? You can find the top 100 list of things that go quickest in a collapse. And this week we're on number 56, laundry detergent. Certainly you want to stock up on laundry detergent, but you also, it's not hard to make your own. And especially if you keep some of those basic supplies around, you can easily make your own. Why is detergent so important in a collapse? It keeps things clean. And in not so great conditions, things that are unclean can lead to infections, can lead to illness, can lead to a lot of discomfort. And it's just good practices to keep things clean. So keep it stocked up and keep some of those supplies around. If you're not a Patreon supporter, I highly recommend you become one. You can find out how to do that on our website, prepping2-0.com. But here's one thing you might have missed from our after show.
Central bank digital currency, what is it? Why is it a threat? And how do gold and silver thwart that threat?
Very simply put, central bank digital currency is something that would allow for the central bankers to have complete control.
Aren't you just a little curious on what the funny quote page segment could be, or what some of the silly things we talk about over there are? You can find out how to become a patron again at our website. Other cool thing, I've done a lot of interviews for us on other shows, talked about it quite a bit, Food Preps 2.0. You can find Food Preps 2.0 one of two places. The best place is just go to our website, prepping2-0.com, right there at the top, right in the middle. Food Preps 2.0, click on it. It's got all the places to order the book. It's got the table of contents, which is pretty hefty. Also has a resource page where, kind of like today, where you might be like, I want to get my hands on one of those. Oh my gosh, I just read about it in the book. Now I have to go research it and spend an hour or two looking through reviews. Nope, you can just go to that resources page. We've done all that work for you and taken a lot of time to do that so that you don't have to, which is awesome. So that is a great website to check out, and you can always find it at prepping2-0.com. I have talked a lot about fermenting on our shows. I've hinted at it, I've talked about it, and I've done it, and then I stopped doing it for a while. Part of it was because we moved, and now I'm back. And what I really appreciate is some of the new tools that I have discovered in this process. So what I want to talk to you about first is, what is the process of it? Well, let me jump back. Let me tell you my history with it first, because then it'll help you understand the process. My history. I started fermenting, gosh, I want to say 5-6 years ago. One of the tools that I used the most was the Ball Jar Fermenting Kit. I'm going to talk about brands and tools today. And that's not bad. I will definitely continue to use it. But now that I have more information that I'm going to share with you today, I get better ways to use it. And the other one was my struggle. And you'll hear about my struggle as I talk about the process. But the thing that you are doing basically when you're fermenting, you're taking a handful of vegetables. The popular one is pickles, cucumbers, carrots, sauerkraut, which is cabbage. I've just recently done asparagus and whatever it is, you've got to take this, you know, handful of vegetables and you need to put it into a salt water brine, which is just simply water and salt. And then you need to push it and press down on it and keep it under the brine. And part of that struggle is keeping it under the brine and none of that food can come to the surface. And we'll talk about that. Well, I was struggling with that and struggling with finding fuzzy things on the, scummy, weird things on top of my food and knowing what was good or bad. Part of the fermenting process is that the food is going to change how it looks as it goes through the process. What's good, what's bad. I kind of knew. I'd read a book or two about it. And then having confidence in that. No, I know that that's supposed to be like that. I know that looks suspect. And how do I know? You know, you have your brain between your ears, but unless you have a little bit more solid knowledge, you know, that's where I was at. Fermenting is maybe something I don't have confidence in. I feel like I know how to do it, but how do I do it and make sure I'm successful almost every time? And it's a lot like canning that way. Like you can can some things and then you look back later and go, wait a minute, there's something fuzzy on that and I don't like it. And then you suddenly lose your desire to do it as often. Well, I'm going to help you out with that today and share with you what I have learned. So part of that is knowing how to find out if things are good. And we'll talk about that. Let's step back and go back to what I thought I was going to start with, but I changed my mind. Wild fermentation. That's what we're talking about right now. It's also referred to as lactofermentation. Shelby, what is that? Wild fermentation is basically taking a vegetable. Again, let's just use cucumbers that you've grown, that you've bought from a store, that you've found at a farmer's market, and you're going to put it in a brine and you're going to ferment it. You are using the probiotics, the nutrients, the things that are in our atmosphere and in our air and on that vegetable that you pick up to promote your fermenting process. And it's wild fermentation because you are subject to the conditions by which you are doing this process. As opposed to, say, like winemaking, commercial winemaking or commercial cheese making or something like that, where that process is very specifically controlled, those probiotics and yeast are artificially inserted into the process to make sure that is the correct process, the correct everything is done and is a very controlled environment and very prescribed and very methodical, as opposed to what I do in my kitchen, which is wild, according to the definition. So, and this is specifically when you're dealing with vegetables, is lactofermentation. And there's kind of three stages to it. And me understanding the stages and what happens in each one, again, boosted my confidence level a lot. Fermentation takes place, specifically lactofermentation, takes place in an environment that has no oxygen. It's an anaerobic environment. So that's where you struggle, and we'll talk more about this. When you have pushed your vegetables below that brine level, that's in an oxygen-free environment. And if they come to the top and they come above that brine level and are exposed to air, now you have an avenue, you have a gateway between an aerobic environment where there's oxygen into your anaerobic, and that's where you can get yourself in trouble. So you want to keep your food below the salt. So I get that. The other thing that helped me out is understanding I understood this, but I understand a way to test it. Knowing that your ferment is in an acidic state and it will drop the pH below 4.5. That is your safe zone. That is where you know there's nothing weird, funky, or bad growing in that environment when your pH is at a safe level. Holy buckets, I wish somebody had taught me that before, that it is worth it to spend a little bit of money on a pH tester. Holy buckets, we'll talk about that. And as that environment is growing in that anaerobic environment, your probiotic rich environment starts growing. That's what's really great about fermenting, is that you are suddenly getting an environment that's growing probiotics, enhancing the nutrients, vitamins, and minerals in that environment. And it's super good for you. And you know that it is safe. So there's three steps. First step, you've put your food into a brine, you've popped it, you've pushed it below the waterline of your brine, and that salt environment starts killing off bad pathogens, essentially, and it starts its process. There's little, like tiny little air pockets in all of this, and you'll see what it is. It's interesting. So those pathogens at first that need that oxygen environment are going to nibble on all of that and use up the oxygen. And those pathogens will also release carbon dioxide, which is why those first few days when you are fermenting, it gets kind of almost fizzy and bubbly. It's kind of cool. That's one of the ways you visually know that this is doing what it's supposed to be doing. And then in those first few days, I'm going to say 2 to 3 days, your pH level will drop. Typically, when you start a ferment, it will be at a certain pH level, and you're going to see this drastic drop. That's where you know that's doing what it's supposed to do. Stage 2, which is generally day 2 to 5, so these stages kind of overlap quite a bit, you're going to see the bubbles. You're going to see maybe the brine might turn a little bit cloudy. That's actually what it's supposed to do. And see, back in my old days, I'm like, Shelby, is it supposed to be that cloudy? That doesn't look right. That doesn't look like the pictures on Pinterest. Oh my goodness. So you want that. Right now in this process, there's 2 acids being produced, which are good in this anaerobic environment that lowers the pH. And it also pushes things up in the brine. So when you started this, everything kind of was pushed down to the bottom and was sinking to the bottom of your brine. But as it's fermenting in those like 2 to 5 days, suddenly things start rising up, which is where I kind of got myself in trouble. And most of us can, because they start rising up as the oxygen is released, and you need to work and make sure that those things are staying below the brine level. It's an interesting process when you understand it. Then there's stage 3. This is when the pH is generally below-ish. I'm going to just throw it should be below 4.5 for sure, if not lower than that. This is when nutrients and probiotics, vitamins and minerals are in a great environment to just grow. There's the rise of lactobacillus, which is a very beneficial probiotic, but depending on what you're fermenting, what the environment is, there's all kinds of them that are being grown out of this, and in a perfect environment. For sure, in this environment, in stage 3, the good probiotics and the good bacteria that's growing is absolutely outcompeting anything that bad that might enter this environment. Because anything bad that enters this environment, and again, is in an anaerobic, no oxygen, low pH level, typically can't, well, they can't survive there. Many probiotics depend on this environment, especially all the good ones that we want, that we spend money on to buy maybe in pill form or capsule form. Again, let's go back to that pH level. That pH level, the safe zone, is below 4.5. I personally, based on some of the information that I've read out there, below 4 is better. 3.5, pretty good. And the longer you let it ferment in this stage 3, that will happen. So your ferments can take anywhere from, and we'll talk about this too, anywhere from like 2 days to 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And there's a varying difference based upon, honestly, the conditions and the food that you're using. So there's short-term and long-term ferments. So let's talk about that for just a moment here. But before I do, let me give a quick shout out to some of our awesome sponsors that you can find over at prepping2-0.com. Click on Friends and Affiliates, and you will find over there some amazing people. First and foremost, Pro One Water Filters. My goodness, make sure you have your water preps in order. Make sure you know how to purify, store, move, transport, for sure, purify water. Make sure you've got some good water filtration in place. And my goodness, Pro One Water Filters is premier in that. They will help you all the way from, you know, simple backpacking sort of options all the way to whole home water filtration systems. Katie Armor stands for Come and Take It Armor. Backwoods Home Magazine. Oh my gosh, I'm sure somewhere in a publication from the last year, Backwoods Home Magazine has talked about fermenting for sure. EMP Shield helps you protect your home, your car, anything electronic from a CME or an EMP. Paul Burke Realtor, Gibbs Arms, and of course, Podcast Access. If you want to start your own podcast and sound awesome doing it, encourage you to check out Andy over at Podcast Access. And you can find all of our sponsors again at prepping2-0.com. Well, let's get back into it. Couple of things to think about. So you just heard me talking about short and long-term and the stages of fermenting. Once you've hit below that 4.5 pH level, and we'll talk about how to test that, you know you're in the safe zone. Could you crack it open and eat it? Absolutely. What if you keep it going longer and longer? You can keep it going longer and longer. And typically things get tangier and zippier the longer you let them ferment. And as long as the pH is looking good, as long as you don't have anything, and I'll talk about what to look for. If you don't have any of the weird things happening, specifically your pH turning into something weird, you're fine. So when you're fermenting, when you're starting it and you're maintaining it and you're in this fermenting stage, the standard temperature is 70 to 80 degrees. So for most of us, that's in our house. You know, in the summer, it's in maybe an air-conditioned house, or in the winter, it's in a heated house. But 70 to 80 degrees is standard. What is one thing that can speed it up where you're like, oh my gosh, that fermented really fast, is adding fruit to it. If you add a sugar of any kind to your ferment, it will speed it up. It adds that extra sugar that the probiotics can feed upon. So let me give you an example. So recently, I did a regular white cabbage sauerkraut, and I started it, got it in a jar, and I kept it out on my counter. So that's the other thing I was struggling with, is I need to check these and be able to have eyes on these every day to make sure they're doing what I need it to do. So I'm watching it, and then about a week later, I started a purple cabbage sauerkraut that had a chopped up pear in it. And I'm testing the pH levels on these every day. And I'll tell you what, that purple cabbage one with the pear in it, it was done within about 5 or 6 days. The white cabbage one took about 2 to 3 weeks to get that thing to the pH level I wanted. Both tasted awesome. Both did really well. But I could really tell that that extra fruit, that pear in there, definitely sped up the pH, which was just interesting to me. You know, when you hear someone give a fact like that and then you see it in action, it's kind of interesting. So that's something to think about as you go through this, as you think about fermenting, as you think about, you know, how you're going to do this. And so the next thing I want to just have you think about, I'm specifically going to be talking about a salt brine ferment. You can certainly make pickles. And people confuse pickling with vinegar with fermenting with salt. And you can do both. The vinegar process is a very different process, although you end up, especially in the case of cucumbers, you get is similar, you know, you get pickles, you get cucumbers that have been preserved in vinegar as opposed to salt. But it is a very different process. I'm just speaking about this salt aspect of this. So I want to kind of go into the tools for me that were game changers. And I'm going to describe them to you and how you can get them. And it is worth the investment. And I say that as someone who's like, oh, I don't need those. I'm okay without them. No, you need them. And I want to give credit to where I got much of this education that I've had recently. I stumbled across, and I talked about it in a recent episode, the YouTube channel Clean Food Living. And it's a gal over there that does a lot of fermenting. And she has a ton of recipes. She doesn't just do wild fermentation with vegetables. She also does kefir. She does sourdough. These are all versions of fermenting. She does homemade apple cider vinegar, which is amazing. some of her recipes I've done, and they're amazing. The purple cabbage recipe I did was hers. That was really good. So totally recommend it. She talks about tools, and she has good visuals. And that really was another game changer for me. When you see things happening to your ferment, like it turns cloudy, or in the case of one of my recent ferments with sauerkraut, like the brine is disappearing. What's going on with that? And what do I do about it? The pH is fine, but that seems suspect. She does a lot of troubleshooting, and she gives you lots of good visuals. Like, I now know how to identify things that are good and things that are bad because I have that visual. I think one of the things that changed for me, I got to tell you how I stumbled onto this before we jump into the break here. I was starting to think about fermenting about last summer or so because I had some vegetables coming in my garden, and I was kind of running out of, you know, I don't want to can anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do something else. And it's part of that whole layering thing that Glenn and I talk about. I need something else to do for preserving this. So I'm like, okay, let's think about this fermenting thing again. Let's revisit it. And I really wanted a kraut pounder. What's a kraut pounder? It's like this wooden bat. It's what it looks like, a small wooden bat that you use to just pound sauerkraut. When you are first fermenting sauerkraut, you kind of got to beat on it a little bit and kind of loosen it up. And the whole idea is to loosen up the sugars that are in the sauerkraut so it softens up quite a bit. Well, I was looking online for one and couldn't find one that wasn't really expensive. Like, it was like $40 for a wooden bat. I can buy a bat. I can take a hammer and do better than that. So what I did keep finding, though, is that I could find these fermenting kits that had a sauerkraut pounder in it for like $25. And I'm like, well, I'll buy this stupid whatever this kit is because I'll get this pounder for cheaper than it is by itself. So I bought one of these kits that had these lids with it, had this weird bike pump with it, and had the kraut pounder. What else did it have? And it had weights, which I'm familiar with weights. They're little glass discs that you press down on top of your ferment. You've heard me talk about how you need to weight down your food under the brine. I've seen these weights before. They can be expensive, but I'm like, okay, I haven't ever bought these before, but, you know, I'll get weights in the whole deal. I didn't know what the bike pump and the lids were for, and I didn't get it. I didn't understand it all. Oh, that was the game changer for me. Now that I know what those lids and bike pump are for, totally a game changer for me. So that's kind of what got me started, is going back and, okay, let's look at this again. So again, I give huge credit to Clean Food Living as I'm watching through her channel, and I look at her do a video on the different lids out there. And she talks about them. She talks about the ball ones that I've been using. And she said, yep, I use these and they're good and they're decent. Her favorite ones, though, are the bike pump ones. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I already have some of those. Tell me about it. What's really cool about these, and I'll talk more about this as we come in after the break, is that they really do take out that element of oxygen in the lid and in the upper part of your ferment. So when things bubble up to the top in that day two or three of that process I was talking about, let's just say a little peppercorn or, you know, some sort of spice or a piece of that asparagus gets to the top and is at the top and it's exposed to oxygen and you did all you could to keep it from doing that, you now have a way of removing and sucking out the oxygen that's in between the top of your jar and the lid. Game changer. Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to talk to you guys more about all of the great tools that can give you amazing confidence in fermenting and creating some really amazing, yummy food that will last you for months. I have so much more to talk about. Join me on the other side of the break.
More Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher is coming right up. Hear all our previous shows free online at prepping2-0.com.
Are you a prepper or homesteader looking to connect with like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own preparedness group? Already have a group? Well, look no further than PrepperNet. PrepperNet is dedicated to personal responsibility, individual freedoms, and being self-reliant. PrepperNet has monthly meetings in over 100 cities where you can meet and learn with like-minded people in your area. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Find us online at PrepperNet.com.
Prepping 2.0 is about that next level of prepping. One of the key 2.0 items to have is bulletproof body armor plates. I used to think body armor was too tactical for a regular guy like me, but it isn't. Give yourself, your family, and your team an unfair advantage when bullets are flying. Body armor used to be expensive and hard to get. Not anymore. KD Armor, and that stands for Come and Take It, makes solid and affordable body armor for normal people. Get body armor while you can. The clowns in Congress are trying to prohibit future sales. KD Armor is the place to get it. CATIArmor.com. Prepping 2.0 listeners get a 10% discount when you use the coupon code GRANT.
When the grid goes down, darkness will descend fast. Used to be there was nothing you could do about an EMP, electromagnetic pulse, or CME, coronal mass ejection. Now you can protect your electronics, protect your family, thanks to EMP Shield. EMP Shield invented a simple-to-install device that prevents whatever's connected to it from frying in an EMP or CME, and it costs just a few $100. EMP Shield has been tested by independent laboratories and passed muster with the government, which has ordered lots of them. Google EMP Shield and see for yourself. And save some money. Get a $50 discount per device. Go to prepping2-0.com. Click on the Friends and Affiliates page, then click on the EMP Shield logo. At checkout, use coupon code PREPPING2.0. It's all one word.
Shelby Gallagher here. We found that you need to layer your food preps.
Yeah, this is Glenn Tate here. A lot of times the hardest part of layering is the long-term foods. We love Numana foods, which have a 25-year shelf life and are non-GMO. Also, organic meals are available.
Numana comes in family-style portions and in bulk. This is not backpacking food. It's family meals that last for at least 25 years, the perfect freeze-dried part of your food layering.
You can get a sample of Numana meals for $19.95 and see for yourself. You will be amazed.
Prepping 2.0 listeners get a 10% discount by entering the code PREP.
Go to numana.com or click the link on the Prepping 2.0 website.
Give it a try. Numana.com. That is N-U-M-A-N-N-A.com.
Without water, you're done in 3 days. Pro One Water Filters. It's literally a matter of life and wet. Pro One G2.0 all-in-one gravity systems are NSF ANSI 42 component certified.
Not everybody can say that.
No need for additional add-on filters to reduce fluoride. Pro One stainless gravity systems include a stainless steel spigot and a countertop stand for no additional cost. Pro One Water Filter Gravity Systems. Check them out at ProOneUSA.com. That's P-R-O-O-N-E. USA.com. Most tested, most trusted.
In a tactical situation, your AR is your life. Gibbs Arms makes a sweet feature, the only side charger that can use a standard bolt carrier group with no modification. Gibbs makes them in 9mm, 5.56, and 308. In fact, Gibbs Arms has been granted 8 patents for unique innovations. The company started back in 2008 when two Boeing engineers realized no one else made what they wanted. Take a look at their website and see all the ways Gibbs Arms can help you mod your AR. Gibbs with a Z, arms.com. That's GIBBZARMS.com.
Now, more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for rejoining me, Shelby Gallagher, over here at Prepping 2.0. Again, Glenn is just not with me today. He's out and about slaying dragons, no worries at all. But we're just getting started talking about fermenting with confidence and some of the new tools and resources out there that can make it so you're like, no, I know that I can do this right. For even more, though, stick around in the after show because I've got so much to talk about. I don't know if I'm going to get to cover it all. But wanted to just jump into our archive dive of the week. I want to encourage you all to go back to episode 75. We talked to Bob Main way back when, firearms expert, talking about buying your first handgun and your everyday carry firearm. Say a quick prayer, if you might, for Bob. He has had recently had an injury that's been kind of a long recovery. Encourage you to pray for him, and hopefully he'll get back to slaying dragons here really soon. And it's been a struggle, and I understand what that's like. So as you all know, yeah, keep him in your prayers. Good dude. That was a great episode, and I learned so much from him. So the other folks out there I want to give a shout out to is Numana Foods. Holy buckets, literally holy buckets. Numana Foods specializes in bulk freeze-dried foods to really check off that list. I need to get a week's supply, a month's supply of food for my family now and make sure I'm ready for XYZ coming up. Great way to do that is with Numana Foods. They specialize in good, wholesome food that is ready to go and be ready to be stored for a long period of time. Super great people over there. You can find them at prepping2-0.com. Click over on Friends and Affiliates. They're there, and I do believe that they have a really good coupon code over there. So we were talking about the tools that you can now use in fermenting. I was talking about the lids, and I will come back to that here in just a moment. But there's really four things that you need to know to look for when you are doing your ferments. First of all, sight. So let's just say I open up my lid from my ferment and I see just a real flat kind of film and it's white on top of my ferment. And if you like, let's just say I pull a pickle out of that and it's gonna have like this granular film that it might leave on my food. That's typically calm yeast, K-A-H-M, calm yeast. It is harmless. It won't hurt you. It's not going to, you know, make your stomach upset or cause you to have to go to the hospital or anything like that. It's kind of gross. You can certainly just rinse it off. Some people eat it. I'd prefer to rinse it off personally myself. But again, over at Clean Food Living, you can see video examples of what this looks like. And if you, especially if you have calm yeast that's been growing there a few days, it can give you the impression that it might be moldy. And anytime you think you have mold, if there's any doubt in your mind, you throw it out. Well, I can tell you right now, between ferments that I've done that I've seen a cloudy brine with calm yeast on top, and I don't know what I'm looking at, I have thrown out a lot of perfectly good food. And that's that confidence that I didn't always have before, but I do now, now that I've seen real world examples. And I have to say, Clean Food Living, she has done a great job above any other page that I've seen of giving you really good examples. She also has examples of this is not good. You want to throw it out. Basically, if it's fuzzy, it goes. It's out the door. So there's the first, the sight of it. The second thing you want to look for is the smell. If you open up your ferment, it should smell salty, foody, zippy. It should smell good. It should not have any sort of a putrid, gross, nothing crazy smell to it. It should smell good. The next one is the pH, and I want to talk about that. Testing your pH level and knowing what your pH level should do during your ferment is really important. And again, I wish I had known this. There's three ways to test your pH. The first one is pH strips. Many of us use that. And they're fairly accurate. And what it is, it's a little, almost like tear-off strips. Think about tear-off matches. And you dip it in your liquid or whatever you're testing. And it'll come up with a color code that you compare it to. I mean, think about like testing pool water or something like that. And you can get within the range. So when I've done this and I look at it, I'm like, I think it's close to a 4.0, but it may not be. It doesn't tell me a number. It tells me a color range. So that's the problem with pH strips is that you don't really get a number. Super inexpensive. If you're confident in your fermenting and you're like, if it's in that color range, I'm confident, then feel free. It is an absolute viable way of testing your pH. There's also two digital ones out there, and I now have them both. One of them is a basic digital pH tester. It looks like a thermometer, and it's black and white, and it's in the $10 to $20 range. And we've had one for a long time. We still have it, actually, from when we had a hot tub. And you're testing your pH. And it is super easy to use. However, it is not easy to calibrate. And all of the digital ones need to be calibrated accurately. And it's hard to calibrate because the instructions aren't super clear in how to calibrate it. And I, even to this day, I'm not sure if that's calibrated correctly. And I did it a while ago. So you can find these again, and I will put these links for these up in the show notes that we have for today so you can see the difference. But those are fairly inexpensive, and they're in the $10 to $20 range, if I recall. The other problem with those, for these digital ones, the tip where you dip it into the liquid, very delicate. And on this one, if you accidentally break it, you have to buy a whole new one. as opposed to kind of this upgraded, new to the market, new technology, where it's more like a probe. It almost looks like, you know, a large digital thermometer that you'd put in your mouth, kind of thing, under your tongue. And it's got a cover on the probe that you can screw on and screw off. So you can really protect that cover. Super easy to calibrate. The instructions are much better. A little bit more expensive. I found mine in the $30 to $40 range. And I will put that in the show notes as well. Much more accurate, much more easier to calibrate. And you can use this thing on a whole host of things. You can use it not only in your ferments, you can test your pH of meats, of your sourdough bread. If you're into wine making or cheese making, you can test your soil with the tip of that thing. Just don't jam it into a rock. This thing will test anything. And that is encouraging to me because there's many times I'm like, I should probably test my soil, but I don't want to spend the money on it. So encourage you to think about that. Again, these are things that in the past I've been like, I don't really need to test my pH. No, I should. And it's a good thing too. So that is one of the tools that was a game changer to me that gave me confidence in my ferments big time. Because the first thing is your sight. Make sure you know what you're looking at when your ferment starts changing, to testing the pH. When you start a ferment, you're going to put your vegetables in a jar, you're going to pour your salt water over it, and you're going to put a weight on it. Test it. It should be typically, because it's salt water, in about this 6.7-ish range, 6.8. I've had mine, the last one I did was 6.87. And I typically will test it every day. And because this probe is super easy to use, I just stick it in there, open up my lid, stick it in there, test it. And just like I was speaking of earlier, in that first 2 to 3 days of a ferment, that pH should drop because it's an anaerobic environment. The air is being used up, CO2 is being released, good probiotics are taking over bad pathogens, all that huge process is beginning. And it is shocking to see. One day it'll go from 6.7 to 5.2 to 4.2 to 3.6. And just a few days it drops. And that right there is a confidence builder that you're doing it right. That pH testing gave me confidence. I'm doing it right. If it doesn't drop, when you're doing a ferment and it's not dropping below 4.5, something's wrong. You know it's bad. Throw it out and start all over again. But that's a huge, give me numbers that I can test so I can see and know that I can have confidence that this food is doing what it's supposed to be doing. Awesome. The other thing with that is to keep your food at the top of your jar, at the, you know, the neck of your wide mouth jar. Typically people use wide mouth jars because when you're stuffing food into a jar, having the wide mouth is wide mouth canning jars is the lid of choice. And when you buy the bike pump, I'm going to talk about those now, the bike pump and lid, those will fit any wide mouth jar. Game changer. Because of that oxygen pocket that you create. So let me walk you through this because this is amazing. And I'm going to have a link to this as well in the show notes because this is a game changer. So you put your food in, you put your brine in, you put a weight on top of it. The glass weights are super handy. You're going to spend a little bit. There's other ways to make weights. I'll talk about that in just a moment. And then you're going to put the lid on top of it. And this is what I would always do in the past. I put a lid on top of it. I would check it every few days. But then within like day 3 to 4, suddenly there's something weird on the top. It could be the comm yeast. It could be the fuzz. It could be something. And it's because during that process of fermenting, as things soften and CO2 is released, things get released and they can float to the top. And if you don't catch them and they touch that air that's at the break of the water line there, suddenly you have a mold and suddenly you're throwing it away. And the problem for me has always been getting that little bit of oxygen out. Well, that's what this bike pump's for. It's a bike pump in reverse. This is the best lid for fermenting ever created. So you put the lid on. And the other cool thing with all of these lids that I've seen that's got a little dial on it so you can basically mark the date that you've started your ferment, which has been really helpful. Because as you know, from what I've just described, knowing where you're at in your three-stage process of fermentation is really helpful. So you put the lid on, you screw it down tight, you put the bike pump on, and it's a bike pump in reverse. You are sucking the air out. And you can suck a lot of air out of there to the point where it is an oxygen-free void of space between the top of your ferment and the top of the jar. Super huge. I will say this, since I've been using these lids that I accidentally bought last year, I've not even had calm yeast on the top of my ferments. I'm shocked. I'm shocked at how amazing they are. And I'm excited to also, now that I have a little bit more confidence in my fermenting, is going back when I find them, because they're still packed away in some of our prepping supplies, going back and getting the ball fermenting lids. I'm excited to use those more for the sense of when my ferments get past that about 5 to 6 day stage, when they're really sunken below and they're down below the brine line and they're just kind of cooking away. They're at about a, 3.7 pH, and they're just sitting in there developing their nutrients, and they're not moving around anymore like they do in those first few days. I like the idea of pressing down with this spring-loaded thing that the ball ferment kits come with and using those instead. You can use a whole variation of different lids and things to make them, but being able to use this bike pump to suck the air out was a game changer. The other thing that's really good to know about, again, is the weights. There's the glass weights that you hear everyone talking about out there in the fermenting world, but you can absolutely make your own. What have I done in the past for weights? People have used rocks before. There's a little controversy out there. Maybe they are dirty, maybe they aren't. Make sure you scrub it really good, but there could be some sediment in there. Well, however you feel about using rocks, if you're uncomfortable with having a bare rock exposed to your food, just wrap it in plastic or put it in a baggie and put it on top. Or even better, if you have marbles, put it in a baggie and drop it on top and use it to press down. You can use decorative rocks. I have a whole lot of decorative rocks. Something that weights down evenly distributed across the top of your jar is wonderful. And especially if you use something like that where you're using rocks that are maybe protected by a plastic bag, you don't have to then use a mason jar or a canning jar. You can put it in a pot or a crock of some kind. And that's a whole different world. It's all the different crocks that are out there. But I'm just thinking about some of the videos I've seen where there's like a soup tureen and nobody uses soup tureens anymore, but drop some pickles in there and put some rocks on top of that. You've got yourself a nice little ferment going. So there's all kinds of different ways to do fermenting, and you don't have to be locked into, I have to use a mason jar, I have to use this or that. But if you're like me, where I needed some confidence, I already have wide mouth jars, quart jars in particular. Having these new lids that make it so I can really remove that air that has been troublesome to me, and being able to test the pH, huge game changers for me, and being able to have confidence in my fermenting, which has been wonderful. So let's go back and talk about this. So we have our site. How do we have confidence? We have our site, we have our pH level. The last one is smell. We talked about, make sure it doesn't have a smell. If you've passed all three of those tests and you're like, I think it's good, my pH is here. And I'm actually excited now when I get to this stage, whereas a few years ago, I'd be like, okay, I think I can taste it. I think I can taste it. You can taste your ferments at any time. But if you get to this point, smells good, looks good, pH is good, especially if it's really dropped a lot and you're close to that like 3.5 stage, oh, I'd totally taste it. I encourage you to taste it. You should have a tangy, zippy, somewhat crunchy, because at this point if it's fairly early in the process, it shouldn't be limp or anything like that. And they're really good tasting food. If you even bite halfway through and you're like, doesn't taste good, spit it out, throw it out. The taste test is your final taste. And it would be surprising to me if you went, especially with the pH level, if you went through all three of the first stages and you tasted it and it tasted bad, I'd be shocked. I don't know that that would really ever happen. So kind of some cool things to think about. There's also short-term and long-term ferments. Some of the short ones that I see out there where they go super fast, like the ferment is over in like a day or two, are typically, like you heard me talk about earlier, those ferments that have a fruit in them. Well, one of the fruits out there that we all like to use, especially because we end up with abundance of them in the summer, is tomatoes. There's some great ferments out there. They're going to go super fast when you do them. You can ferment just cherry tomatoes. Take some cherry tomatoes with some, I don't know, a few slices of onion, garlic, and some basil leaves. Oh, super yummy. They're going to ferment pretty quickly. You can ferment some salsa. There's some great salsa recipes out there. They're a typical salsa recipe, and then you just throw it in a jar with a brine, and you're there. You need to eat them pretty quickly. So those will create a short-term one, and then there's the long-term ones. When you have more dense foods, especially vegetables that aren't full of sugar, they're going to take longer. That's going to be your cabbages. Typically, I recently started one with Brussels sprouts, kind of that same family. Tastes super good. You're going to look at like 2 to 3 weeks to get them done. So think about that where you're like, I'd like to have some vegetables to eat through the fall and winter. They will last you quite some time. So let's talk about that a little bit. How do you make them last for a while? Well, you remember I talked about earlier how some of the best environment for fermenting is in that 70 to 80 degrees. And when you are done, where you're like, this tastes good, this looks good, it's got the flavor I want. But wait a minute, Shelby, what if it doesn't have the flavor I want? I want it to be a little bit tangier. Put the lid back on, suck the air out of it, and wait a few more days. Just keep trying it every few days. But let's just say you're now at the point where, no, this is good. I want this to stay pretty much this way. Put a different lid on it. Put a regular, I would say, non-metal lid on it, because metal and salt tend to corrode together. But put a regular, just any old lid on your jar and put it in the refrigerator. That cooling effect slows down the fermenting process a whole lot, to the point where it will seem to you and I that it has stopped. It hasn't. It's actually continuing. But that food, as long as it's under and in the brine, can last a long time. Let me give you an example of how long that can last. I moved some carrot ferments that we had in Western Washington here to Montana, kept them refrigerated, kept them in that cold environment, and they are still good today. I don't want them to keep going because, well, first of all, they're carrots that have been fermented with jalapenos, and jalapenos, when they're fermented, are mind-blowingly hot. So they're a little too hot for me now, but they can last a long time if you keep them in that really good environment. You're going to run out of space, so think about your refrigerator space as well. But that cooling effect, keeping them in the brine, under the waterline, you've got food that'll last you months to a year plus, which is amazing to think about. So the other thing that we really haven't talked about much is how nutritiously better fermented foods are for you. We've talked about this numerous times on this show, how being able to can your food, you're going to lose some nutritional value in that in the heating process. Being able to freeze dry your food, you actually maintain quite a bit of nutritional value. If you are going to dehydrate, you might lose some nutritional value. You know, that's part of the whole thinking about preserving, is retaining nutritional value, and that the process that you're applying to the food doesn't ruin too much of it. Fermenting is the one that I think, from what I've learned, this is completely Shelby's opinion, is the one you are preserving your food and you're actually boosting the nutritional value. You're creating probiotics that are great for digestion, and they are varied and vibrant and not just in pill form. And they also boost the nutritional, the vitamin mineral value. And we talked about how that happens really in stage 3. There are fermenters out there, and I'll give you one. Here's a name of like the dude when it comes to fermenting is Sandor Katz. His last name is K-A-T-Z. He argues both ways. Should you stop your ferment sooner rather than later, or should you let them go and go and go until you grow more and more in nutritional value? And he lands either way. But he has had some good discussions out there about how the longer you let your ferments go, the more nutritionally varied and vibrant they become. And he's like, you know, it can be argued if you want super good nutrition, let them go longer. But then there's also those of us who are like, you know, we want our fermented salsa now. It's Taco Tuesday. We want it now. So there's some variations in there. And I think there's pros and cons with each one. And, you know, do both. You know, again, I have ferments that I've had for years, probably should eat them up. I'm going to, or chop them up and make, you know, put them in a recipe or something. And then there's those that I'll probably be making some salsa this summer that plan to eat it within a week or two. Yeah, so think about how you can incorporate fermenting into your food preps. We talk about it, of course, a little bit in Food Preps 2.0, but there's some amazing things you can do. And I also want you to think about, or at least I've definitely thought about this, it's not just pickles, it's not just cucumbers. One of the best recipes, and I've joked about this before on our show, is one that I did that it's kind of a takeoff of if you've ever gone to a taco truck and you get a few little kind of fermented carrots with maybe an onion and a jalapeno kind of as a little side garnish, and they taste super good. I have done those and fermented them. And when I've put them out on our table, when people have come over, I don't even have to take them out of the jar. I just hand everyone a fork and we just stab and eat. And what I find crazy when we do that is people are trying to stab the clove of garlic that's in there to eat, to just put that bad boy in their mouth and go. Amazing things you can do with all kinds of different vegetables. You can use as one of your preservation systems if you want to ferment garlic. You've got it. Great way to preserve garlic so that you don't have dried up, shriveled, you know, garlic raisins on your counter or in your cabinets. You can ferment just onions. A great way to have onions to put on your hamburgers, you know, when you make hamburgers or want to maybe garnish something with a few slices of onions, is just onions. And what's nice is that fermenting process kind of takes off that raw onion kind of bite that not everyone likes. Another one that I've seen too is, well, we've talked about carrots, we've talked about Brussels sprouts, asparagus, there's just carrots in general, fennel. Kimchi is another one. Kimchi is an Asian kind of coleslaw, I guess you can say, and there's all kinds of variations of that. Oh my gosh, there's so many things you can ferment. And then if you get interested in this aspect of fermenting, then there's the whole world that grows out of that, where you might look into making your own kombucha, kefir. Of course, the whole world knows how to make sourdough bread, but part of sourdough bread is being able to test your pH, which is, it is a fermenting process to be able to make that. So I hope I've been able to kind of walk you through some of the awesome tools out there that are available to you that can really give you way more confidence in your fermenting, just like I've experienced this last year as I accidentally bought a product that I didn't realize how awesome it was. So folks, for Patreon supporters, I can't wait to have a chat with you over in the after show. But for the rest of us, don't forget from Benjamin Franklin, failing to prepare is preparing to fail. Have a great week, everyone.
You've been listening to Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher. All the information you've heard today, including all our previous shows, is online at prepping2-0.com. Find out more about Glenn's books at 299days.com. and Shelby's books at agreatstate.com. Learn about the latest book they authored together at foodpreps2-0.com. Until next time, be smart, be safe, and be prepared.